Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin today's reading with a feature from this month's Sports Illustrated entitled The Mets, an owner who appreciates the finer things, no matter what the cost, shelled out a record amount for Juan Soto. And this feature is written by Sports Illustrated writer Tom Verducci. One clue that you are talking to the richest owner in baseball and one of the 40 richest people in the U.S. is the answer provided when you ask about the rarity of owning a Giacometti. Pieces by Alberto Giacometti account for 4 of the 5 most expensive sculptures ever sold at auction at an average price of $106 million. Quote-unquote, which one? The story of how Steve Cohen, billionaire hedge fund trader and owner of the Mets, came to acquire a 4th Giacometti sculpture foretold the greatest acquisition in the auction environment that is baseball free agency. It was May 11th, 2015, a little bit after 7 p.m., smack in what photographers call the magic hour, when Cohen arrived at Christie's Auction House in Rockefeller Center. The last hour of sunlight, low and soft, slathered 49th Street in gold. Cohen walked through a bronze revolving door and headed for the main sales room, a two-story cavern that can seat a few hundred people on its floor. Major bidders such as Cohen, though, may follow a sale anonymously in private skyboxes. Up for bid that spring night was Giacometti's L'Homme aux Doigts, that is, Pointing Man, a piece that the artist created in one frenetic night back in 1947. This was its first time coming to auction. According to the Christie's catalog, quote, cast in bronze and standing whippet thin at 5 feet 10 inches, this dynamic and powerful figure is widely recognized as one of the most important sculptural achievements of the modern era, created by the greatest master of the medium, unquote. It estimated the price would go in the region of $130 million. Cohen, who began collecting art back in the year 2000, had purchased another Giacometti only 7 months earlier at auction for $101 million. He wasn't interested this time. "I went in there not wanting to buy it," he says. "And then I had this thought in my head," Cohen says. "It was like, you would have the best Giacometti collection in the world. And then I decided, I'm going to go for it," unquote. The bidding opened at $100 million. It quickly went to $105 million, then $110 million, $115 million, $120 million, and $125 million. Cohen went to $126 million. The auctioneer checked with 2 rival bidders. There was no response. With the auctioneer's swift banging of the gavel in his left hand, Cohen owned another Giacometti. He walked into the room with no intention of buying it and walked out having paid the highest auction price ever for a piece of sculpture, $141.3 million, including the buyer's premium. Sometimes, he says, in the moment, you get a little carried away, unquote. Almost 10 years later and 4 seasons into his ownership of the Mets, Cohen entered the auction for free agent outfielder Juan Soto, this time very intent on buying. Having just turned 26 years old, Soto is one of the most reliably elite hitters in baseball history. He is the only player to have 7 seasons through age 25 with an adjusted OPS of no worse than 142, a ranking that levels out factors such as ballparks and hitting environments. It means in his worst season, Soto was still 42% better than the average player. He has the highest floor in baseball. I look at it pretty simply, Cohen says. There wasn't going to be another player like him on the market, maybe in the next 5, 6, 7 years. So this really was an opportunity to bring someone in at an age where you were getting him in his prime years. That's pretty rare. I mean, we already had a pretty good club. This was an opportunity to get a special player in an opportunity that may not exist for a while, unquote. The bidding for Soto made Christie's look like a school bake sale. It was like bidding with a bag over your head, Cohen says. Cohen thought that Soto was returning to the Yankees, but Cohen, a guy with an art collection worth more than $1 billion, won the biggest auction of his life. He signed Soto for $765 million over 15 years. It is the most money guaranteed to an athlete and the longest contract given to a baseball player. Winning this auction was more meaningful to Cohen than winning the Giacometti, which would be on private display at his Greenwich, Connecticut home. This win goes towards a public trust. A Mets fan during his childhood in Great Neck, Long Island, Cohen wants badly not just to end the franchise's 38-season World Series championship drought, but also to end his beloved team's reputation as the Wile E. Coyote of baseball. Often entertaining but rarely successful, the Mets always seem to be one cell away from finding Acme TNT explode out of a would-be gift box. Soto, hitting between sluggers Francisco Lindor and Pete Alonso, adds historical greatness to a team that last year came up just 2 wins short of the World Series. The Mets are loaded with offense, sass, and swag. Young stars on the rise, a dominant closer, and a manager who takes every wicked turn of a New York season with the placidity and skill of a driver negotiating Le Mans. They also have pitching depth, but for now lack the high-ceiling, stuff-centric starters that teams prefer in October. I said in my opening press conference, if I could turn this organization around, I could make millions of people happy, Cohen says. That's my philosophy. I view it as somewhat philanthropic. I'm not trying to make money. We're trying to win. And I love the fact that I could change how the Mets are perceived, how the Mets fans perceive themselves. And if I can pull it off, wow. I've just made New York City and millions of fans happy. It's a civic responsibility. Listen, we have a foundation. We do a lot of philanthropic things, but I felt that this was different, unquote. There remains one part of the Soto signing that Cohen and his general manager, David Stearns, admit that they still don't comprehend. Why did Soto choose them? Scott Boris, Soto's agent, says that he had four suitors offering in the range of $700 million or more: the Mets, the Yankees, Red Sox, and Blue Jays. I tell Cohen that I'm going to ask Soto the next day why he chose the Mets. And I'm curious what he's going to say, Cohen says. I mean, I'm hoping that it was the conversations. We met multiple times. Was that something to do with it? Was it the perception of family and how we treat families? Maybe it was he wanted to be his own man. I mean, we can all speculate. And I really don't care because he's with us now, unquote. Almost 3 years ago, Boris took a piece of paper, wrote a number on it, tucked it into an envelope, and stashed it in a desk drawer. It was the number that he thought it would take one day for a team to sign Soto as a free agent. When Cohen made his first offer for Soto, Boris did not need to consult his secret number to know what to make of it. Boris told Cohen that it was the worst of the initial offers that he received. Quote, "Steve, you're not even in the hunt," unquote. "All right," Cohen harumphed, "I'm out." Boris says that he wrote an email to Cohen the next day, which said, quote, "Steve, my job is a couple things here. One is to represent the player, but the other thing is to give you a vision for the market so you compete in it. So when I tell you that you are non-competitive, you should view that as good news, because then you have the opportunity to be competitive. Otherwise, I'm going to say that you should drop out," unquote. At 7:30 that night, Cohen called Boris. "All right, I'm open," Cohen said. "Okay," Boris replied. "I'm going to probably have a couple of evaluation rounds." "Well, how many are there going to be?" "I haven't determined that yet." "Why?" "Because I have to optimize the market. I have to really see if people see what we see, because right now they are not. I have a surplus value of $1.5 billion for this player," unquote. Boris compared Soto to former clients Greg Maddux, Alex Rodriguez, and Max Scherer, free agent outliers with surplus value. That is, they returned more value to the teams that signed them than they were paid. Boris's models defined Soto as worth as much as $1.5 billion. Cohen reconvened with Stearns. They arranged to meet Soto and his representatives, including Boris, at Cohen's home in Boca Raton, Florida, on December the 6th. The meeting did not go well. Soto told Cohen one of the most important prerequisites was protection in the batting order. Soto never had a big bat behind him until teaming with Manny Machado on the Padres in 2022 and 2023, and then Aaron Judge with the Yankees last season. Soto told Cohen the Mets did not have enough protection to suit him. Cohen grew so frustrated by the tenor of the meeting that at one point he snapped, "Why are we even having this meeting? It sounds like you're coming up with a lot of reasons why you don't want to come to our team," unquote. When Soto and his team left the house, Cohen told Stearns he's going back to the Yankees. "That was my gut feeling," Cohen says. "I was having a hard time coming up with a reason why he would join us," unquote. The next morning, Boris called Cohen. "That was a really, really great meeting yesterday," the agent said. "What?" Cohen said. "That was one of the worst meetings I've ever been in." "Juan liked you.
you definitely checked the ownership box, unquote. Okay, great. At 3 p.m. the next day, Sunday, Boris's phone rang. It was Soto. You have my direction to go final with the Mets and try to work it out, Soto told his agent. By the end of the night, Soto and the Mets agreed on the richest contract in sports. None of the money is deferred. In net present-day value, Soto bested the previous record contract of Shohei Ohtani by more than 60%. He's a numbers genius, Boris says of Cohen. I say different things to Steve than I would say to most owners because he is so adept at just transacting. He is also adept at deal-making because he dealt with the art world where your market is nobody else's market because you want the art. Because your vision of the art has a real market in the future, unquote. The Mets were christened with a strikeout on May the 8th, 1961, in the Crystal Room of the Savoy Hilton. Owner Joan Payson announced the expansion team that would return National League Baseball to New York for the first time since the Brooklyn Dodgers left for Los Angeles in 1958 would be called the New York Mets. To commemorate the event, Payson picked up a Stan Musial bat while someone held a bottle of champagne. She took a swing at the bottle. Nothing happened. She swung again. Strike two. She swung a third time. The bottle fell to the carpet intact. Strike three. The waiter took his turn next. He used a bottle opener. The Mets have won the World Series twice in their history, in 1969 and 1986. Each title is mentioned in the same vein as Lourdes. Each ranks among the most miraculous World Series ever witnessed. In 63 seasons, the Mets have finished in first place only six times and reached the playoffs only 11 times. Never in three straight years. The team's spring training clubhouse is festooned with giant images of the franchise's greatest homegrown players. Tom Seaver, their only homegrown player enshrined in the Hall of Fame as a Met, and Daryl Strawberry, Ed Cranepool, Dwight Gooden, Eduardo Alfonso, David Wright, and Jerry Kuzman. They epitomize what it has meant to be a Met, more endearing and entertaining than fulfilled greatness. Further, of the 17 pitchers in history with the most strikeouts in their first 50 games, four pitched for the Mets: Dwight Gooden, Matt Harvey, Noah Syndergaard, and Jacob deGrom. Each of them was a comet, spectacular to behold until they fizzled out. What defines Mets ambience nearly as well as such charismatic players are the many famous comedians who root for the team. The roster includes John Oliver, age 47, Sebastian Maniscalco, age 51, Jim Brewer, age 57, Ty Burrell, age 57, Jimmy Kimmel, age 57, Kevin James, age 59, Hank Azaria, age 60, Chris Rock, age 60, John Stewart, age 62, Ray Romano, age 67, Bill Maher, age 69, and Jerry Seinfeld, age 70. Why in the name of Mr. Met, the huge-headed, ever-smiling OG of live mascots, do comedians fall for the Mets? Comedians are attracted to well-drawn, outsized personalities, Seinfeld says. We don't like people that efficiently go about their business. We like people that entertain you and hopefully go about their business as well. I became a Mets fan when I was just so entertained by the personalities and the color versus the Yankees. You know, the orange and blue versus the depressing navy, unquote. The vein of colorful Mets characters has been strong from the beginning, starting with Casey Stengel as the franchise's first manager and Marv Thornberry as its first cult hero. In his 27th game with the expansion 1962 Mets after a trade from Baltimore, Marvelous Marv was called on for obstruction while botching a rundown play at first base and was called out on appeal after missing first base on what was a triple and struck out to end the game. When Stengel came out to argue the call that Thornberry had not touched first, one of the umpires stopped him in his tracks by telling him, "Don't bother, Casey. He missed second base, too." Marvin Eugene Thornberry defined what it meant to be a Met. Literally, it was right there in his monogram. And it has been 39 years since the Mets won the World Series. Seinfeld was at Shea Stadium during the miracle against the Red Sox that was Game 6 in 1986, having taken four flights from Montana to get to his seat in the yellow upper deck. I still remember sitting there. The game ended, and I just couldn't leave my seat, Seinfeld says. Game 6. I just went, "What? What was that? What happened?" I couldn't absorb it. Again, personally, you know, that was such a Mets thing, just like 2024 was. I mean, 2024, my God, if you were a Mets fan in 2024, you're branded for life. That was so much fun, partly because of how unexpected it was, especially after the way the season began, unquote. The Mets became only the third team to reach the playoffs after losing 33 of their first 55 games in a full season. They were the best team in baseball after that, at a record of 67 wins and 40 losses. They did so in their trademark comic book style, outsized and colorful, adopting Grimace as their unofficial mascot, riding the good vibes of infielder Jose Iglesias and his hit single, OMG, and turning City Field into the biggest karaoke bar in Queens every time that Lindor came to bat. The run ended 2 wins short of the World Series, a familiar, not-quite-there ride for Mets fans. Says Stearns, who, like Cohen, grew up rooting for the Mets, quote, "I think we share an appreciation for the scars and triumphs that the organization has gone through, that the fan base has experienced as well. These lived baseball traumas, and yet you still firmly believe that greatness is around the corner. And now it's partly my job to help greatness be around the corner," unquote. A friend recently remarked to Seinfeld that he was worried that the magic of 2024 could not be duplicated this year. "I said to him, just be glad that you have what you have," Seinfeld says. "You have a game that you love. You have a team that you love. Don't look any deeper than that." He was saying, how could 2025 be anything like 2024? How could Monday be like Tuesday? That's not the way life works. You're so lucky that you have anything. When you get older, you appreciate baseball more and more. You realize how few things in life you really have that are companions like that. You have a well-run team. You have a team where you have confidence in the ownership, the management, and the on-field management," unquote. Seinfeld has become friendly with Cohen, the son of a dress manufacturer and a piano teacher, who took the train to Shea, bought a ticket to the upper deck, and tried to finagle his way into the lower deck. Steve Cohen immediately established himself with his wife, Alex, as having a fan-first attitude, Seinfeld says. And that's what fans love more than anything. Our owner's a fan. I mean, it's a dream, unquote. Juan Soto wants to get one thing straight. Quote, the Yankees were number one, he says, of his preference entering free agency from day one. There's another thing he wants to get straight, a rumored incident between Yankee Stadium security and his mother last season did not happen, at least not as portrayed. Nothing happened, he says. All this news that came out that security brought my family around, that they don't let them be and all that kind of stuff, that's not true. The security in the Yankees, those guys were A1 with me and my family, unquote. Oh, and another thing. He says that he did not care that the Yankees, according to club policy, did not offer him a free suite for games at Yankee Stadium. The Mets have given him a suite, up to 4 tickets behind home plate for regular season and postseason games, personal security for him and his family, travel assistance for his family during the season, 8 types of award bonuses, a $75 million signing bonus, and an option to opt out after 5 years. The Mets can void that opt-out by adding $4 million a year to the remaining 10 years, which would bring the total to $805 million. The Yankees lost their position as Soto's first choice. The Mets overtook them. How did it happen? It began when Scott Boras arranged preliminary meetings with interested teams at a hotel in Southern California. Cohen would have none of it. He told Stearns to tell Boras that he would host the meeting at his $32 million house in Beverly Hills. Cohen, wearing his ubiquitous Mets cap, his wife, the former Alexandra Garcia, who was born in New York and is of Puerto Rican descent, and her father hosted a lunch with Latin food. They dined on a patio in a combined indoor-outdoor living space with glass panel doors thrown wide open. There was one problem, though. The non-stop grind of chainsaws from a tree-trimming service next door. Geez, Steve, Boras said, we're in Beverly Hills and you've got a tree surgeon next door, unquote. The parties did retreat for a bit to Cohen's home theater, where he screened for Soto a promotional video about the team and its player services. Since Cohen bought the team, he has invested heavily in analytics, boosting the staff of analysts from 6 to 35 and building a state-of-the-art performance lab at the team's Port St. Lucie training site. He plans to invest in AI to improve performance, and he promises that the technology infrastructure will be elite because I've got high standards, unquote. The heart of the presentation sold the Mets as a family-oriented business. Players who have played elsewhere depict the Cohens as especially attuned to the needs of family. For instance, when outfielder Jesse Winker was traded to the Mets last summer, he says that it was amazing the way the club took care of any arrangements for his mother and daughter. Getting traded anywhere is hard, right? Winker says. In New York, in a playoff push, they made it so easy. It's so much easier to come to the field knowing that your family is safe and will be taken care of, and you could just go out and play. It was like the smoothest transition ever. There are other places where I've been that do a really good job as well, but here it's just different, unquote. Says Cohen, that's the way I run my hedge fund. I don't think it takes much. If I can make their experience positive and as easy as possible so they can focus on what they're doing, I'm going to do it. I don't know what other teams do, and I really don't care, but it is important to us." Unquote. The Beverly Hills meeting lasted only 90 minutes or so. Meanwhile, Cohen asked Lindor to gather any player intelligence on Soto. How would he fit in the clubhouse? Cohen has especially close relationships with Lindor and left fielder Brandon Nimmo, both of whom are signed to long-term deals. "I said that I'd do my research," Lindor says, "but at the end of the day, he was just a guy that worked hard. And they did all the research themselves, you know. Steve is somebody that takes people's opinions. He gathers information and makes decisions based on the information that he's got. It's not just him, him, him," unquote. Meanwhile, Scott Boras was doing his own research. One day he asked Soto, "Where is your highest career OPS? He answered, "I don't know. City Field." Of the 15 parks in which Soto has played at least 15 games, City Field, the Mets' home, is the site of his best OPS, which is 1.186. Boras showed him his numbers in seven other ballparks, including Rogers Center in Toronto, Yankee Stadium, and Fenway Park in Boston. The next meeting was at Cohen's $21 million house in Boca Raton. "I'm running out of houses," he joked to Boras, though they had not yet convened at his $23 million Greenwich home. Again, they met over an alfresco lunch, and again, they did so to the accompaniment of chainsaws. Next door, renovation work was happening. Boras and Cohen had to laugh. Soto wasn't laughing. This was the meeting in which he gave Cohen reasons why the Mets did not seem to be a good fit, especially with a lack of lineup protection. When asked why he appeared so pessimistic, Soto smiles and says, quote, "We tried to not show any emotions through the meetings. We kind of kept this process neutral," unquote. The final decision rested with what Boras calls the Supreme Court of Soto. "Who," I ask Soto, "are the members?" Quote, "My mother, my father, and me," he says. "My whole family is important to me, everybody. But when it comes time to decide, that's it," unquote. The Supreme Court of Soto chose Cohen and the Mets over Hal Steinbrenner and the Yankees. Why? It starts with Cohen. Quote, "I mean, the effort that he's put in," Soto says. "He put a lot of things out there. They put my family into it. My family and the way they take care of everything. They have to be taken care of," unquote. There was another separator, trust in long-term success. As you see how long this contract is going to be, it just came down to that decision, you know, Soto says. What do they have in the farm systems? How many times can we be good on this team? I know the Yankees are going to be good for the next 5-6 years. We don't know after that," unquote. Over the past 3 seasons, Cohen has spent $1.25 billion in payroll and competitive balance taxes, 27% more than have the Yankees. Cohen is said to be worth $21.3 billion. 6 years ago, his worth was estimated to be $13 billion. Cohen built his fortune placing high-volume bets on small movements in stock prices. His previous company, SAC Capital Advisors, pleaded guilty to insider trading charges in November of 2013. Cohen was never charged or sanctioned in the case. he opened a new firm called .72 the following year. The Mets' infrastructure is still in startup phase. Until it matures, Cohen's personal wealth is the organizational backstop. As he said in a meeting with reporters, quote, "I've always wanted to be more measured in payroll growth. And until we get there, I have the ability to spend if I have to," unquote. Soto is trusting that Cohen will spend what it takes to put a competitive team on the field for the next 15 years. "That's what he told me," Soto says. "He's going to try to put a winning team out there every year, and he's capable of it. And I give him all my trust. I hope to be happy," unquote. The Yankees, Soto says, simply did not fill him with confidence. "I mean, they made a pretty good effort," he says, "but we went back and forth with a lot of things. We tried our best, but I don't know, it just feels like it's just weird. It's kind of like, how can I explain it?" Unquote. He stops. He looks towards the ceiling. He's quiet for 10 seconds. It seems an eternity, more time that he has in the batter's box to get ready for the next pitch. Finally, Soto says, quote, "I feel like the Yankees did a pretty good job, but they couldn't get it done right. Like, I wanted to get it done, but they're still bouncing around. Here, at least that, maybe no, instead of just getting it done right away. Yeah, just get it done," unquote. It was an amazing accomplishment by Cohen. It was very far from his goal, which is to build the Mets into something that they have never been, a sustainable winner. But it was his greatest leap towards it. He convinced the most valuable free agent in the history of sports that his next 15 years are best spent with the Mets. The Mets of Stengel, Thronberry, Doc, Darryl, the Dark Knight, the eighth longest championship drought in Major League Baseball, and despite last year's success, attendance that ranked behind 17 other teams. Quote, "I think that there's always been a little bit of skepticism with believing that the Mets are going to be sustainable winners," Cohen says. "I think that Mets fans have had this negative perception. One of my goals is to break that negativity. I want that postseason feeling again for me. I want it for the team. I mean, that month was one of the most I had not felt anything like that. I don't know if I've ever felt anything of that type of emotion," unquote. As for Scott Boras's number in the envelope, he will not reveal it exactly, but he does say, quote, "We are very close to it. The final number was a little bit above what I had," unquote. And as for the most expensive piece of sculpture ever won at auction, apparently, unlike pitching, you can have too many Giacomettis. Pointing Man was shown the door. Quote, "It turned out that it wasn't something I really wanted," Cohen says. "I ended up selling it a few years later. That sometimes happens," unquote. As for the Mets' overall emotions this season, more than most, is full of promise. Quote, "I'm either at the game or watching the game every single day, and it's going to be phenomenal," Seinfeld says. He thinks of Soto in blue and orange in the deep lineup that Soto wanted. "That guy surrounded in that lineup is a thing of beauty, and I just can't wait to watch it," unquote, he says. One day in February, Seinfeld was riding in a car with his good friend Larry David, who is a Yankees fan. "I don't understand your life as a Yankees fan," Seinfeld told him. "What?" "I don't understand how you live. That if you don't win the World Series, you fail. And if you do win the World Series, that meets your expectation. That's it," unquote. he let the thought hang for a beat. Quote, "What kind of life is that? What kind of life is that?" Unquote. The line made David laugh. A Mets fan knows not satiation. For now, Cohen has bought them a team that resembles a Liechtenstein print. Bold, bright, fun, loud, expensive. It is something to dream on. The dream is that this time there really is greatness around the corner. And again, that feature is entitled The Mets. An owner who appreciates the finer things, no matter the cost, shelled out a record amount for Juan Soto. And that feature written by Sports Illustrated writer Tom Verducci. And from a baseball feature, let's turn to a football feature. This feature is entitled, Geno Smith Explains Why Stars Are All Aligning with the Raiders. The quarterback opens up about leaving the Seahawks, how much he talked to Pete Carroll last year, his long-standing relationship with Chip Kelly, and now working with Tom Brady. And this feature written by Sports Illustrated writer Albert Breer. Truth be told, when Geno Smith looks back at what landed him where he'll be later this week in a meeting room in Las Vegas listening to an old coach of his again, he thinks of a talk that he had with Seattle Seahawks general manager John Schneider last summer. Smith was heading into his sixth season with the team, his third as a starter, and with new coach Mike McDonald in place, he knew things were going to be different. Along those lines, Schneider was open and honest with Smith. Smith, in turn, steeled himself for what might lie ahead. Quote, "Just based on that conversation, I kind of knew the direction the team was going," unquote, Smith said after a workout in his hometown of Miami. It wasn't a bad talk. There was nothing sinister. Yet Smith's big takeaway was that Seattle wanted to lean into a young core it had built, partly with the capital that came back in the Russell Wilson trade of 2022, a trade that, ironically enough, cleared the runway for the former Jet, Giant, and Charger to finally become a starting quarterback again. In part, as a result of that discussion, Smith went into 2024 knowing that in 2025 he'd be looking to the Seahawks for a recommitment. Beyond just the money, he'd want them to show him that they saw him as their starter for the foreseeable future. Then he led the Seahawks to a +500 record for the third consecutive year, throwing for 4,320 yards, 21 touchdowns, and 15 picks in his first year in a new system. And Seattle, Schneider, and McDonald, for their part, did take a pretty significant swing at getting Smith to renew his vows with the franchise after the season. But even with a solid contract offer on the table, the disconnect that the quarterback felt over the previous summer remained. The offer didn't make an exception to the Seahawks' general rule not to fully guarantee money in future years. It was also well shy of where Smith's camp wanted to be in average per year, so Smith's camp did not bother to counter. The big problem for Smith was how the proposal gave the team escape hatches. By then, Smith saw that he could have one of his own. And in this case, a couple months later, pulling on that hatch has landed him exactly where he feels like he was meant to be. Smith isn't harboring ill will over how things ended in Seattle. This will be his 11th NFL season. He knows how things go. He's also not going to be the guy to tell you that the conclusion of his time as a Seahawk with his trade to the Raiders and reunion with Pete Carroll in March wasn't about the money. But he will say that it wasn't only the money, which is proved out in that he accepted a deal in Vegas last week that wasn't all that dissimilar from the one that the Seahawks had offered him in the raw amount of money written into the contract. Quote, obviously, they have young guys in the building that they want to step up and be leaders, and they got a new head coach last year, Smith says. And Mike was good for us, and I really enjoyed being with him for that season. But again, man, when you're talking about business and you're talking about a quarterback who wants not only to get paid, every player wants to get paid, but to be respected, that's the most important thing. It's the respect factor. And I just felt like there was a disconnect there, unquote. The disconnect, again, wasn't about where the Seahawks were, but where they were going. So Smith went through last year knowing the end could be coming. In a way, for him, it wasn't dissimilar from how much of his career has gone. He played six consecutive seasons from 2017 to 2022 on one-year deals, the final four of those in Seattle. He'd learned how to handle that and keep his focus where it needed to be. But as part of that, he also knew when he needed to vent a little, and he found an unlikely sounding board over the course of the season, Pete Carroll himself. Quote, I would call him whenever I got frustrated, Smith says. He talked me through things, and he still coached me. And I think that that's what makes him such a special man, is that he was coaching me even when he wasn't my head coach. A lot of the things that he was telling me, a lot of the conversations we had, really kept me steady throughout the season and kept my head on straight. Because again, man, this is a team that I gave everything I had to, unquote. There were points when Smith and Carroll talked daily. There were points when they didn't talk for a few weeks. Neither knew whether Carroll would ever get back into the NFL again. Really, it wasn't about that, which was the key for Smith. Carroll wanted to help Smith, plain and simple. In explaining that, Smith simply says, quote, Coach Carroll, man, is a special guy and a special coach, unquote, and one who was there when Smith needed him the most. Quote, it was very frustrating last year because as a team, we set goals for ourselves and we did not achieve those goals, he says. And being a part of the team, being a quarterback, I take that right on my shoulders. And I feel like that's my responsibility to make sure that stuff happens. And we weren't able to reach our goals, weren't able to get to the playoffs. That's the ultimate goal, to give yourself a chance to go out there and win a championship. And that's what frustrated me the most. And then, obviously, not having real security there, not feeling like you're really part of the future plans. There's a lot to think about, unquote. Once the season ended, he had plenty of time to dive in on that. Carroll was hired in Vegas on January 24th, and when contract negotiations went the way Smith figured that they might last summer, Smith's agent, Chafee Fields, laid out trade scenarios. On a call, Fields told Smith that the Raiders were interested. So were two other teams. The Seahawks wanted to do right by Smith. Smith still says now, I had a lot of great teammates there, a lot of people in the building that I loved there, a lot of people in the city. And he believed that Las Vegas might be able to give their quarterback what he was looking for. And while Smith wanted to consider all his options and make a business decision, the pull, he felt, to the Raiders was real. Quote, I just thought the opportunity in Vegas, man, was just too good, too great to pass up, unquote, he says. By the end, it wasn't just Carroll either. The new offensive coordinator in Las Vegas was Chip Kelly, whom Smith had first met as a recruit in the weight room at his South Florida high school. Kelly was trying to get the teenage quarterback to come to Oregon. He didn't land Smith then, but the two built a rapport and loosely stayed in touch over the years. As a result, Smith would watch Kelly's teams and had it in the back of his head that the idea of the partnership Kelly proposed all those years ago was, quote, "one that I've always wanted to explore. We never got the chance to be player-coach, but I've always wanted to explore that. We've always had a good rapport with one another," unquote. That went to another level last year when Kelly was named offensive coordinator at Ohio State, weeks after Smith's outrageously talented cousin, Jeremiah Smith, arrived on campus. The two connected again over that, as Jeremiah Smith posted a 76-catch, 1,300-yard, 15-touchdown freshman season in Columbus, and the Buckeyes won the national title. Gino was watching his cousin closely, of course, but he saw a whole lot more than just that. Quote, "he not just coached Jeremiah, but that entire offense," Smith says. "They had two 1,000-yard runners. They had two 1,000-yard receivers. I mean, they were very, very balanced. They lost two of the best offensive linemen in the country and went out and won the Natty. Watching that team and how he developed quarterback Will Howard and how he got better throughout the season, you see it. So seeing that firsthand and all the schematic things that they were trying to do to gain advantages, and now he's bringing new wrinkles up into the NFL game? He's done this before, and he's doing it again, and I just think that it's going to be a great thing," unquote. Then there was the other relationship that he wanted to explore with the greatest ever. Smith knew of Tom Brady's involvement in the reimagination of the Raiders following the league approving the 7-time champion as a minority owner of the franchise back in October. He had come to find out after he was traded to Vegas how that involvement was anything but some sort of ceremonial thing. Brady FaceTimed Smith right as the transaction with Seattle was being pushed over the goal line, telling him how he loved how Smith had come to master the game in his 30s. Quote, "I've always really been hard on myself about being able to play the game without using all of the physical attributes," Smith says. "And from watching my tape, that's something that he noticed, how I handle protections and can get in and out of plays. He ran a very intricate system last year. It was our first year in the system, but we didn't hold back on anything. And I think that's something that he recognized and noticed. Stuff from the neck up, decision-making, leadership, just all those things are the things that Tom talked to me about and reasons why they wanted me," unquote. Soon thereafter, Brady invited Smith over to his house in Miami to continue the discussion on football, on what it took for Brady to play into his 40s, and on life as an NFL quarterback in general. "We sat down and talked for hours," he says. "You're sitting there and you're like, man, it's Tom Brady. But then again, I mean, he's got a hand in the organization that I'm playing for. There's a lot of responsibility there," unquote. Smith's taking that responsibility head on. Quote, "we're here. We're doing this thing together. And I was sick, man, when Carroll left Seattle. I was sick. And I didn't see it coming. I think it's going to be great for both of us now," unquote. Smith's faith in that was affirmed last week with the agreement on a 2-year extension worth $75 million in new money. Perhaps the most important nuance to the deal was the $18 million for 2026 that was fully guaranteed the minute Smith signed the contract, showing that the Raiders view this as more than just a one-year stopgap. Of course, Smith's well aware of the other end of the bargain, and Brady was direct on that with the Raiders' new quarterback as the deal was being finalized. Quote, "What I was talking to Tom about, this is something he said, and this is true. We don't want to celebrate contracts. We want to celebrate wins," Smith says. And the thing is, that just kind of set the tone for the team. This is our quarterback. This is the direction we're headed. And when you have that, when you can set a real plan, that's when you can get things going. As far as the contract, I'm very grateful, very thankful. But my main focus is to go out there and win games, set the tone, and be a better version than anyone's ever seen of me," unquote. And now, with all these pieces in place, Gene Smith can focus on that and that alone. And again, that feature is entitled, "Geno Smith Explains Why Stars Are All Aligning with the Raiders," written by Sports Illustrated writer Albert Breer. And that's all the time that we have for this reading of Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.